Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Shill Report, episode 12, where journalism is reviewed and the stories of the week are expanded and explained. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me on this quest to shed the light of liberty on the week's news is publisher of We Are Libertarians, Mr. Chris Spangle.
Hello.
And managing editor of the We Are Libertarians news site, Joe Ruiz.
Morning, fellas.
You know, we are truly blessed on this podcast, gentlemen. We're coming from one excellent week to another. Joe Ruiz, booking agent extraordinaire, has brought to us, has got an excellent guest for us yet again. We have the incredible honor of welcoming Mr. Jeffrey Tucker to the podcast. First of all, Jeffrey, thank you for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
It's really great to be here. I like using this technology, and this looks like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, that's great. Now, for those of you not familiar with Professor Tucker, he is the executive editor of Laissez-Faire Books. He's a distinguished fellow of the Foundation for Economic Education, and an adjunct scholar with the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and an Acton University faculty member. He's also the past editorial vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute and past editor of Mises.org. So essentially, he is the smartest man on this Google Hangout. Fair enough?
Absurd.
I think that's fair to say.
About to be proven wrong.
So those credentials are vast and impressive, Professor Tucker. And I was wondering if you would, just for our benefit, tell us a little bit about Laissez-Faire Books, your work there, you know, your current roles in the various positions we mentioned, and just, you know, kind of not necessarily a day in the life, but just some of the activities and projects that you're working on, and just a little bit of background about yourself.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. I was with Mises for many years. I jumped over to Laissez-Faire. This is an old company. It was founded in the early 1970s. In many ways, it was the book publisher that built a libertarian world. You know, it was back in the 70s when you couldn't download anything. There was no internet or anything like that. You had to get your books through the mail. And Laissez-Faire made them available. They had a cool catalog. And in so many ways, they were responsible for all the distribution of cool things back in the 70s, 80s, and really 90s. Then, with the internet, it kind of went into a decline. And eventually, it was taken over by Agora Financial in Baltimore. They held it for a year and couldn't really make a go of it. So they hired me as a way of kind of figuring out some innovative strategies for making literature available online. And we started the Laissez-Faire Club that distributes books on a subscription model, which is fun. I mean, when we started this not quite 2 years ago, nobody else is doing it. And now there's all these startups going on. I think I saw the other day there's a startup called The Oyster that is just doing book publishing through a subscription model. So it's kind of nice. We aspire to be the Netflix of libertarian literature. And it's neat to see other people kind of picking this up. So I feel good about that. I do a lot of my writing, too, for the Foundation for Economic Education. Here's a very old institution. It's founded in the 1940s. Once again, it's gone through ups and downs. But nowadays, my old friend Larry Reed is the president. Carl Oberg is doing development over there. Max Borders is the editor. And he runs all kinds of innovative articles. And I'm really excited about writing for them, just because they're able to take on risky topics. I mean, already this year, you know, I've written about a lot about technology. I wrote about Bitcoin, you know, which is a pretty edgy topic for them. I wrote an article on why I'm an anarchist for fee.org. So, I mean, they're out there taking some real risks, which, you know, when you ask me to write, that's what you get. So.
Well, and one of the credentials that I did not attribute to you that I should have is that you are an accomplished writer. And actually, in one of your books, and Joe actually put me on to a number of your books, and one of them, A Beautiful Anarchy, really just caught, there was a line in there that caught my attention straight away, and it actually resonates with the mission of this podcast. And the line is, once we had to be fed like prisoners, now we make or order our own meals. So in other words, people with this new technology, with these new platforms, they can create their own sources of news. They can be their own outlets, and they've almost shifted the paradigm on what news really means. And I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, what are the long-term implications of this shift in the flow and in the content of this kind of information? Where do you see this game kind of playing out at?
As a result of the migration to the digital world, we're seeing the destruction of all kinds of hierarchies all over the world. The political systems as we know them are completely outmoded at this point. people used to believe, dating back all the way to the Middle Ages, that they had to have some big shot to represent their interests, you know, to some governmental body. We always had to have intermediaries between us and the thing we wanted, because we weren't powerful enough. We didn't have the tools. Gradually, over the last 500 years, we've seen a devolution of power from central organizations and institutions down to individuals. It's happened just generation by generation, but through innovation, not really through political change. And the most astounding innovations in the history of the world have happened essentially in the last 10, 20 years, really even the last 5 years, where every individual has the power to do essentially anything. Manage your entire life, connect with anybody on the globe through trading relationships, communication, innovations. It's changed everything, and it's smashing nation states and smashing hierarchies and destroying all the institutions that people used to take for granted. Essentially, the institutions that have been constructed for us since World War II are now proving themselves to be outmoded and pointless and really a drag on civilization. And what excites me most about this is that technology is the thing that's making it possible. In other words, it's through economic change that we're seeing an enhancement of human liberty. That's an extraordinary thing because it goes a little different. It's taken a different path than what any of us really expected. And states are actually very panicked about it. They keep trying to hold it back. The major upshot of most government policy today is to stop development, to roll back innovation, to throw us back into the past, because they're worried about their own power. They're worried that the technology is making states and political hierarchies irrelevant, and I think they're right about that. We're looking at a very bright future, and that title, Beautiful Anarchy, is what I use to describe, I think, the future we're looking at, a world without nation states, a world in which anybody can communicate with anybody and establish a relationship with anybody in the world. That's the thesis of the book, and that's what I see unfolding in our time.
Yeah, Professor Tucker, news outlets, because this is a journalism podcast, news outlets are often called the mouthpieces of the state or the fourth branch of government. And here on the Show Report, we aim to educate our listeners about bias, influences acting within the media. What are the news sources that you rely on, and what is your approach and philosophy when you're seeking out and digesting the news of the day?
Well, I like to read a lot of the mainstream news, but you know, the New York Times is probably my favorite outlet, not because of their interpretation. You have to have a decoder ring, essentially, when you read things like the New York Times. Like, everything is in there, but it's all got a kind of a crazy spin. So you have to sort of re-spin it. It takes a certain degree of sophistication and experience to figure out how to do this. But anyway, it's the establishment's organ. The establishment has to communicate with each other, so that's an important way. One of the things you find with the New York Times, you have to read the whole story, because sometimes the stuff that you really, really need to know is in the second or third paragraph towards the end. Yeah. So, and then the Wall Street Journal, I hope these aren't disappointing to you, because I mean, this is mainstream stuff, and I wouldn't, it's not good to give to a child, right? I mean, this stuff, it's mostly baloney. But you know, you get a look at the world the way the establishment sees it. And I like to know my enemy well, I guess.
Makes sense. Now, with the current social media landscape, people are breaking down these barriers of traditional media, yeah, though. And we've discussed that this is leading to good things. At this point, do we have all the social tools and technology needed to move liberty forward, or do you think that there's still gaps in our tool set?
I think that, well, yeah. I mean, there's always gaps. You never know. One of the most exciting things about freedom is that, and liberty, is that it leads to surprises, you know, things you never would have expected. I was just writing an article this morning about how nobody really has ever known for like 100 years or more that there was a possibility that money itself could improve, for example, that it could be subject to increasing quality. And Bitcoin has done this for us. I mean, cryptocurrencies, innovations have shown us these things. And just nobody really thought that that was possible before the innovation came along. So, you know, I love all kinds of social media. I think LinkedIn has really empowered workers like nothing else ever has. Twitter is like an endless source of fascination. I'm glad about the IPO coming up. And of course, you know, Facebook and, you know, Google Plus communities, it's exploding. You know, nowadays when people say, well, let me give you a video call, you in your mind you think, well, let's see. There could be six different technologies in which that would be possible just from this one device. You know, that's kind of amazing fact. But I do think that we as libertarians and liberty lovers still need another tool. And I've been putting my mind to that topic a lot recently. And I have some ideas and some plans which I'm going to be unveiling, I hope, before the end of the year.
Well, so, we hope we can talk to you about that idea.
Yeah, I want to get in front of this because I do think we're lacking in some tools. So we'll see.
One of them
might succeed, might not. We'll see.
As a former editor of Mises.org, you know, I just recently got a Kindle. As I'm looking through all of the ebooks available, I'm thinking this is just an amazing tool. Yep. It is single-handedly competing with the educational system.
Yep. You
know, and the more that people know about it, the more that their minds can be opened up to a different way of thinking about economics.
Right.
And the Mises model of putting the content everywhere and making sure that it is available in any way, shape, or form, where you want it, how you want it. I presume, based on your biography and the timeline, that you had a large role in developing that mindset. And
right.
I'm interested in hearing how that developed, because it
right.
just it is so amazing to go and see this body of knowledge that is available for free that has lit a spark, especially amongst the millennial generation.
The story really essentially is that, I mean, I distinctly remember the moment when I realized the power of digital media. I was sitting at my desk, and I had an article from a newsletter sitting about 5 feet across the room, and I had previously uploaded that same article onto the internet, you know, a couple of days earlier. And we're talking about very early on. This might have been, you know, 95, maybe early 1996, and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Do I want to reach over there and grab that newsletter? I just want to kind of type it into my address bar and look at it. And I kind of like monitored my own behavior so I could try to gain an inventory of what I should be doing in the future with this great new tool. And I found it was much easier just to pull it up on my computer. And I reflected on the fact, well, is it because I'm lazy? Well, probably. That's probably part of it, you know. But then I imagined, well, let's say I could do this with books. You know, that would be amazing. But then it struck me that the point isn't really finding the easiest path from here to there, although that's part of it. The really core power of the internet comes down to its reproducibility. In other words, if I have a newsletter sitting over on a bookshelf 5 feet away from me, that's the one copy. I'm the one consumer of it. But if I can take that newsletter and migrate it over to the digital cloud, that suddenly becomes available to 7 billion people simultaneously forever. That's a gigantic difference. So I began to realize that with the internet, you tap into the power of something immortal and something infinitely powerful. And I just, realizing that was an overwhelming realization. You know, once you get something on the internet, it becomes weightless, infinitely portable, malleable, so you can change it, indestructible, because it never depreciates. It's just like, you know, physical property falls in value, digital media doesn't, and it lasts forever. So it's an amazing thing to reflect on. It's like magic. So once having realized that, I thought, you know, what should this generation do? Well, we should dedicate ourselves completely to getting everything online in every conceivable digital format possible. And we started with HTML, of course. And then we started doing PDFs once we got good scanning technology, which hadn't always been available, actually. I went through several iterations of scanning just to get good clean copies up. Then we moved to there was briefly in the iterations of this technology, there was a thing called the Palm Pilot. which nobody remembers now, but it was an early digital device, and we started making books for the Palm Pilot. It was an early ebook, and then we started, you know, making every kind of format possible, and I kept digging further and further through the archives, and eventually I think we ended up with hundreds of, if not thousands of texts up there. But then one day, and I think it was maybe 5 years ago or something, maybe 6 years ago, one of my developers had mentioned the growing popularity of the EPUB, which is the format designed for nowadays, you know, for Kindle or for iPad or just any number of these tablet computers. And my first thought was, because that, you know, despite my reputation, I'm actually not an early adopter. I get exhausted from all this stuff, right? And then I thought, well, look, we put up HTML, we've got PDF, we played with this crazy Palm Pilot thing, we've got now audio, people are wanting video. You know, the number of formats is just ridiculous. Now you're telling me there's yet another one that I need to go, you know, embrace? You know, how do I know that this is going to be the last one or even a good one? But then I got a tablet, I downloaded it, and I saw that this was the ultimate sort of way to read. I mean, it was very obvious that it's superior to every other format. So we started working like crazy to get everything up in EPUB. That was an expensive undertaking, but it's the one that I think that made the most difference. Now you can just download thousands of books in the libertarian tradition that otherwise would not be available, you know. So it's great. I mean, I'm glad Gutenberg is out there, all these great resources, but I'm really proud of what we did with Mises' work. The other thing that we did was, instead of copywriting books, we publish into the commons, which is today's word. It doesn't mean communism. It just means that we won't be using government to assign a strict monopolistic ownership over a text, but rather grant universal permission for the text to be acquired, republished, remixed, reused. So we started publishing in the Creative Commons. That made a big difference because you take the element of fear away from things, you know, the fear of the copyright police. So I took that no copyright model and took it over to laissez-faire with me. I think it is the libertarian publishing system. I think it's the way to protect authors from industrial cartels created by the state. So it's that combination, you know, of publishing into the commons while being as generous as possible with its distribution that I think was the key, was the magical key. And I'm really glad to have played a central role in this.
How? Let me ask about intellectual property and how to make a living at all of this stuff. That is sort of the struggle of the digital age, and newspapers are struggling with it. I know here at We Are Libertarians, we put in probably 20 hours a week as a second job, and we don't get paid for it. We do it because we love it. How do you see a funding mechanism? If we don't copyright material, if we can't really, you know, libertarianism, I would say the most pure form of publishing is that you wouldn't copyright things. But how do you fund all of this great work in the digital age?
Yeah, I think there's a real confusion out there. People think that because something is published without copyright, that means it's not commodifiable. And that's not really true. Now, by way of background here, you know that there are two kinds of goods in the world. There's scarce goods and there's non-scarce goods. Any kind of text that you put online is by definition a non-scarce good, and it's going to have a tendency to drive down to zero price. So it's going to be difficult to charge for any goods in the digital age. On the other hand, it's entirely possible to charge for the service of the delivery of the goods. And that's what iTunes does. I mean, that's what Amazon does. And you can do that with or without copyright. It shouldn't make any difference whatsoever. You're providing a scarce service, or you're scarcifying the service in order to be able to make a profit at it. So I don't see a contradiction between publishing in the commons and commercial ambitions. I mean, at laissez-faire, I set out to prove this, actually. We publish everything into the commons, yet we sell subscription distribution. And it's worked out very well. I'm not saying that's the solution to all things, but every institution has its own kind of model. I mean, Google found a model. It sells the non-scarce good of its search and then sells the scarce real estate of people's screens for advertising. That seems to work out very well. And You just have to. It can be a little bit of a trick. But I'm here's another thing. The other day I wrote an article and I put a tip jar up on my article, and I've been getting. I probably have received like 50 or 60 tips for this one article I wrote just by having a little tip jar on the site. I never really thought much about that, but I was overwhelmed with the response. So it's kind of cool. There's a lot of different ways to do it. In other words, I don't think that copyright assists in commercial ambitions. I really think in many ways it's at odds with it. And libertarians need to get out in front and sort of showing us that there's a unity between the free market and profitability. We don't need government to establish monopolies over our content in order to make them remunerative for us as individuals.
You know, another area that perhaps we do not need government is currency, as you mentioned earlier. And Bitcoin, at least in my opinion, has reimagined currency. I mean, again, we use this word often, but it's almost magical how the emergence of Bitcoin has... All of us can take a Bitcoin and do anonymous exchange of goods with anyone in the world, which is absolutely amazing and unprecedented, I believe, unless you want to count barter. But even back then, across the world was difficult. So it's born of the free market, where no governments and no relationships are required, completely voluntary. We can exchange our goods. We can exchange our media. However, the mainstream press is struggling with this idea. I think this is really, you know, spun currency on its ear, and they don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, aside from the changes to currency markets that are bound to occur, what are the long-term ramifications of the mass adoption of cryptocurrencies and their usage in a digital world? And why has the press completely fumbled the football on this massively historic event?
Well, to understand Bitcoin requires that you kind of comprehend a lot of different things. You've got to understand monetary theory, cryptography, open source development, peer-to-peer exchanges. So you've got to know a lot about computer code and monetary systems. It's just a lot. And open source development, I think, is something that's still mysterious to people. Like, most people don't even know why Wikipedia works, you know?
Right.
So Bitcoin represents a fundamental challenge. What's cool about the protocol itself, when Satoshi Nakamoto released this thing, he didn't publish it in the St. Louis Fed's quarterly monetary policy review or whatever. He didn't go to the American Economic Review and publish it. He didn't take it before a group of monetary economists to say, what do you think about my idea? He just threw it up on a free forum and said, hey, here's a protocol for a new digital currency. If you like it, try it out, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, forget it. So it was completely, sort of blowing up the old hierarchies, just toppling the elites from their power, and just saying, here's my currency, give it a try. And over the following, 8 months, the thing went from having zero value to actually obtaining a market value for the first time, and it was totally amazing, just a kind of a revolutionary tactic for undermining central banks and political establishments and top-down public policy. You can't forget that money really constitutes half of every economic transaction. And so the implications of Bitcoin are revolutionary for the whole world. I mean, one of the most exciting aspects of Bitcoin, you sort of alluded to it, is the fact that it holds out the potential of including a vast number of people who are currently excluded from the current cartelized, monopolized, and privileged financial and monetary systems around the world. Right now, if you don't have a credit card, you don't have a bank, or if you're just in happen to have bad neighbors who put you in a range of IP addresses that are excluded from any kind of shopping, you're out of luck. It doesn't matter how economically productive you are, or what kind of goods you have, or how much money you have, you can't buy and sell. That's a weird system, and it's a direct consequence of government monopolization of money, because the transmission of money, of payments, today relies fundamentally on third-party trust relationships. And if that trust relationship isn't there, you're doomed to exclusion and poverty forever. Well, Bitcoin just blows that entirely away by bypassing the third-party trust relationships entirely, re-physicalizing money, within a digital cloud by creating the sort of blockchain ledger that it lives on distributed networks. You know, every node that wants to download the blockchain, it can't. And there's title assignment between every digital unit and its owner. And then those units are under our individual control, and we can transmit them individually, peer-to-peer, with any other person in the world. It's kind of cool, because what Satoshi Nakamoto did is he got the best of the old gold coin system, where money was really just a form of property, and united it with the best of sort of, you know, digital age technology with cryptography and open source development, and shoved the two things together to re-physicalize gold, re-scarcify it, make it infinitely mobile, and geographically non-contingent, you know, so that it's like I can trade with any physical property with anybody else in the world. I mean, this is just pure magic. What, to my mind, what it does is it puts a big parenthesis around the age of central banking, which is basically the last 100 years, closes it off, and throws it out. We don't need that crap. You know, let's get rid of it. You know, so, like the big delete button for the last 100 years of monetary bullshit.
Exactly. So, you know, this, you know, as I've listened to you talk about Bitcoin and you know, the Kindle and the ebooks and the IP and all that, I'm wondering, and this is kind of an off the cuff idea, has the technology movement almost made voluntarism mainstream? And what I mean by that is, do these technologies work because they're voluntary? And is this core libertarian principle playing out in front of us without the general public realizing it? And could this idea that voluntarism is what works, you know, because if you think about it, Facebook, you have to accept friends. You know, you decide to participate. You know, and you decide whether or not to download a book. You decide whether or not to connect on LinkedIn. You decide on all these things. The state decides for you whether or not you are born and you are subject to the state. So there's no decision, correct? And so I'm wondering if voluntarism is playing out here, and if, you know, the mainstream doesn't realize it yet, but could that philosophy, could that idea actually be what dismantles the state eventually?
I think that's precisely right, but there's one step missing here, and I think that what people need to become conscious of it. You know, the old Marxists used to say this class struggle is all around us, but we need to become conscious of its existence in order to bring about the revolution. That was the Marxian point of view. I mean, that's basically my point of view too. Anarchy is all around us, but we need to become conscious of its meaning and its implications and its productivity for our lives and for the creation of beautiful, prosperous things in the world in order to further the revolution. So I think we need that intellectual consciousness. And to me, the job of a libertarian today, voluntarist or anarchist or however you want to say, is that we need to participate in this sort of digital techno revolution, and the complete and continue to be part of the breakdown of the old order, and then also embed ourselves in a big way in the educational project to just draw attention to people about the fact that these are self-ordering systems, that they're powered by individuals, not by politicians. That the idea of political representation in today's world is essentially an anachronism that doesn't work. We are really, truly living in the age of the breakdown of the nation state, a little bit by a little bit. I think it's been going on for probably 25 years. We're only now becoming really conscious of it. And it's going to accelerate the more we become conscious of this reality, and the more we sort of embed ourselves into the reconstruction effort. I mean, every revolution has three stages. There's the learning, and there's the doing, and then there's the displacement. And I believe we're heavily into stage two right now.
And so that, if I'm understanding this right, by deciding to not use government copyright on books, that's a method of you're almost creating an island of prosperity that works around the state. And is that do-it-yourself libertarianism? Is that the method? Is that our weapon? Or how does that?
And I think it's good for us to throw ourselves into these things. I mean, everybody needs to try out Bitcoin. You know, people, when they publish their books, they need to do it into the Creative Commons, by which I don't necessarily mean give it away for free, but use Creative Commons as we need to eschew government systems as much as possible, both for ideological reasons, but also because that's what's the most benefit to us as individuals. And I think we need to intensify our convictions that liberty really does work. It's not just something we believe in as a matter of principle, although we should. It's also the most workable system for us as individuals and society. It has unimaginable amounts of power connected with it. And once you can combine the force of human liberty with the sheer magic of the digital age, which is just this gift that's been given to us, we're going to see things that are completely surprising. I mean, my favorite example is Bitcoin, because, as I say, nobody even imagined that something like this could work 5 years ago, 10 years ago. If I'd said to any existing living monetary economist, including many free market economists, you know, here's a protocol that's made of ones and zeros, and I'm going to give it away to the world on an open source basis. Can it become a global monetary system? I mean, nobody would have said, oh, sure. Yeah, that's a no-brainer. That could happen. But, you know, one guy was crazy enough to try something outrageous and reckless, and, you know, and it worked. So we need more of that. We need more of us trying outrageous, reckless things, going with our instincts, blowing up systems, disrupting the world as we know it.
So
these are revolutionary acts, absolutely.
So if we boil it down into a soundbite, it's more like you can't just read the gospel, you must live it as well.
Oh, I think that's right. It's not just enough to read it, and it's not just to live it. You have to do both things. Your religious training is working towards your advantage here, I hear.
Very good.
I think that's exactly it. We have to be doers and hearers and doers of the word, as they say.
And I think that hits back at Chris's optimism for the next generation, where they have embraced the ideas, they're living the ideas, and hopefully a few generations down the road, we see the culmination of libertarian ideals, and they take over. So
yeah,
that's wonderful.
I wanted to speak to what Chris was saying here, because I was struck by his initial opening comment about being at the ISFLC, I guess it is, and seeing the future of libertarianism. Because that conference had a powerful impact on me, too. I was really excited. At the same time, I walked away realizing something important about seeing so many young libertarians so excited. There is always in every generation a possibility of burning out. If people can get tired, they can get frustrated, they can fail to see progress and decide it wasn't worth it. They could blow it off as a useful enthusiasm and move on to something else. The question is, how do you prevent burnout? And after many years of thinking about this subject, I think it really comes down to this. Libertarians need to get beyond just hating the state. We all hate the state. I mean, to discover the state and its evils is a powerful thing, but it can also cause us to despair. And despair is the beginning of the burnout, and the burnout is a tragedy for human liberty. So how do you counter that? I think we need to cultivate within our hearts and our minds a true burning, not just hatred of the state, but a genuine love of liberty. That's really the key thing. We need to see its beauties, make it part of our lives, embed it in the practice of how we conduct our lives, how we go about our professions, education, everything we do. And then I think that develops in us a sense of not despair, but hope. And that makes the libertarian idea more sustainable and makes it a persistent feature of our lives. And that's when I think beautiful things begin to happen.
I think that's a wonderful commentary on the current movement, and I think that's an excellent way to avoid the burnout. Let's move into a few stories about the state that I'm sure we're going to be able to dissect. The first one, wow, that comment just kind of – I love that comment, Professor Tucker. Thank you so much for that. That take the hate, shift it to a love of liberty. That's wonderful. You've paused me for a moment. But
good.
But moving forward, we have a situation in the Senate. And so our current reality is that we do have to deal with the state and the government. And right now they are working on legislation to define a journalist. Right now, as amended, this new piece of legislation would include individuals who have been employed as a journalist by media organizations for at least 1 year in a 2-decade period or at least 3 months within the five-year window, along with student journalists and those with a substantial amount of work as a freelancer. So in addition to these rules, federal judges would be permitted to cover other individuals with the privilege when circumstances warrant. So now, on a bipartisan basis, Republicans and Democrats, they've effectively come together to shred past Supreme Court rulings and the First Amendment into confetti. What are the implications here, guys? I think we have personal liability and risk to ourselves now if this legislation is passed. But, you know, let's start with Joe. I think you're nodding your head there. What implication do you think that such legislation has on our work, on Twitter, on people like Matt Drudge who breaks stories and then becomes big? You know, what does that do?
Oh, well, I guess it makes us a black market media outlet. I don't know. but I see something like that, and I look at the way they worded it, and I think, where do they come up with this language? Where does – I mean, what did that say? 2 year – or, sorry, 1 year in a two-decade period? Like, who amongst them sits around and says, this is the way that this needs to be worded. This is the way that this needs to be specified. It just strikes me as kind of silly, and, it can't – be anything more than just kind of a power grab at this point. They want to define who a journalist is the way that they often try to define everything else. And, I mean, essentially, I ask the question, will that create criminals of people like us that we are libertarians who are trying to put out honest news from an alternate perspective?
So, Chris, are you surprised to hear Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont, essentially say that they want to balance national security with shield laws, and that, you know, again, we hear this argument about the NSA destroying Fourth Amendment rights for residents or for citizens in the U.S. and privacy globally. You know, we hear this balance argument, but now we have an outspoken Democrat. Is it surprising, or is this just more evidence of, you know, vote Republican or Democrat, it's still oppression, still force, and still the state?
It's not just Leahy, it's Graham, it's also Chuck Schumer, right. It really is Dianne Feinstein. It's a killer's row of big government, and I think the devil's in the details. John Cornyn of Texas tried to expand it a little bit, and maybe that expansion makes it of course we want to expand it as far as possible, but then doesn't that leave it up to more interpretation? Take Glenn Beck, for instance. Here's a guy who started a media outlet, put a lot of money into it, has a TV network. Does he fall under these guidelines, or is it, you know, the big four? Are they in the New York Times and some of the more traditional outlets? Are sites like ours, where, you know, we don't do reporting, we do opinion making, and do we fall under that? Is it just who is? I mean, there's a wide variety of questions to come out of this. And their intention, of course, their intention is to protect media outlets. So the media shield law protects media outlets when they are reporting on things like the NSA. For instance, Rosen from Fox News and the CBS reporter who is escaping my mind. When they're doing these investigative journalism pieces, they're protected under the Media Shield Act. But it is a clever way to define what a journalist truly is and then exclude people that may not be friendly to big government.
I'd be kind of interested to hear from Professor Tucker. Professor Tucker, when you have things like Bitcoin and you have things like these shield laws, okay, so the government will obviously try with, you know, Edward Snowden, with whistleblowers, with the NSA. There are attempts to regulate the technology that is out there for us to take advantage of. And when you have a conversation saying something like, you know, our liberty can essentially be realized by our participation in these mediums, you know, they're obviously going to try and take from that. And make it to where, you know, we can't reach the ultimate means that we're trying to reach. Do you think that it's a possibility that they could prevent liberty in the long run? Or do you think that ultimately you know, our cause will win out no matter how hard they try.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing is in many ways. I mean, I sort of have to giggle about it because it's laughable and it's a sign of desperation. This is a cornered rat, essentially. You know, the bigger picture here is that over the last 100 years, communications has been almost entirely monopolized by government. It's very important for government. Okay, the government needs four key things. It needs to control the money. It needs to control the security apparatus. It needs to control justice and the court system. And it also needs to control communication. That's extremely important. And it mostly did for the big part of the 20th century. It owned all the radio waves. It owned all the television stations, more or less, even though they're sort of private cartel, kind of like the Federal Reserve in some ways. But in the 1930s, the only media really had access to was fireside chats from Franklin Delano Roosevelt and a few dance bands, you know, and so on it went. But then finally, you know, in the 2000s, in the late part of the 20th century, everything just blew up entirely. And you have to understand what a complete panic that really has led to on the part of the establishment, you know, not just the government, but also it's sort of hooked in media apparatus, which is, you know, kind of a fourth branch of government in many ways. So, yeah, they're struggling to put it back together again, and they're going to continue to. But, you know, this stuff, it's over. I mean, the game is over. They have lost. So these are kind of, in many ways, pathetic attempts. I mean, government will just be radically ineffective at this. I mean, my favorite example of government ineffectiveness is the drug war. I mean, don't forget that Richard Nixon decided he was going to get rid of all marijuana distribution in the U.S. And you know, the war on narcotics has been going on now for 30 years, and narcotics are more available than they've ever been. I mean, pot is like the most mainstream drug ever. It's been a ghastly failure. If anything, it's caused the opposite reaction. I mean, drugs are probably more popular than they would otherwise be if we had like a pure free market. People don't like to be controlled. It annoys the hell out of people. And so right now, I mean, it's hilarious. I find it just, you know, just so funny to me that you've got all over Washington these people claiming we're having this big war on drugs. Jails are filling up, you know, fines, DEA, you know, the whole security apparatus, the dog sniffing agents everywhere. Meanwhile, we've got, you know, 3 and 4 large-scale narcotics marketplaces now operating in the dark net, where anybody can go and buy methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, and any kind of variety of pot that they want using a digital currency. That's the reality. I mean, the government has essentially no power anymore. It can talk, it can warn, it can cause a lot of damage, it can be a big pain in the neck, but it can't get rid of the human desire for freedom. And, you know, the idea that they're going to somehow control the message, you know, in the age of where we're all living in the cloud, is just the ultimate kind of silliness. I mean, it's an indication of an unprecedented amount of arrogance. It's not surprising, but it is truly ridiculous.
A lot of times, ridiculous people, you want to engage them, and then at a certain point, once you've engaged them enough, you realize how foolish they are and how irrelevant they are, and so you just stop talking to them. At what point do we just say the government is so foolish and irrelevant that let's just move along? You know, you have to be
clever about it. I mean, you know, I really admire the Dread Pirate Roberts, this guy who started the Silk Road in many ways, because he didn't take power very seriously. He was fearless, but he was also very clever and wise. I mean, you don't want to walk into traps. But you have to be very clever. And this is essentially the way the dissidents broke down the Soviet state, for example. They understood how evil and nasty the government can be, but they also understood that it's kind of stupid and slow and lumbering and idiotic. So you have to kind of keep both points in mind and sort of navigate the new world with both those things in mind. The Dread Pirate Roberts, you know, made the Amazon.com of narcotics and has so far evaded all attempts to control it by using all the newest tools like cryptography and the Tor browser and digital currencies and that sort of thing. So, you have to be clever, but you also have to be bold. The thing about the state is that it is stupid as compared to the market. You know, I always see almost, you know, all of human history is essentially a race between between the people and the state. And the people are best of distributed nodes and quick thinking. We can crowdsource our information and act on the best that becomes available. It's this information generator, you know, all the time. Very nimble and quick and amazing. The state is a bureaucracy. It doesn't act fast. It doesn't act well. It can't assemble, accumulate, extract information from the social order nearly as well as the market can. So we'll always have an advantage. That's why we see human progress, essentially, you know, because we're always ahead in the great race between power and the market. So, yeah, we can all do our part. And I think you guys are doing your part with this very cool podcast, everything you do. I mean, it's a matter of being brave and bold and fearless, essentially. There's no way they can control this in the end.
So another story in the media, and one that highlights kind of the dangers of the state, you know, I think we all agree it is lumbering, it is slow, but it also controls justice, and it wields it as a weapon. And as we're finding out, you know, CEO of Yahoo, Melissa Mayer, and Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, they are being very vocal right now. Apparently, but the tech industry is taking a lot of backlash for their participation and almost complacency with the NSA programs. And so they're striking out and saying, look, essentially, if we don't cooperate and if we tell you what's going on, we go to prison. Mm-hmm. And so they are striking back. They are trying to get that message out that, you know, we've filed lawsuits. We are doing the legal means. But if we say more than what we're allowed to, we just go to jail. And I think, Joe, you made an excellent point about this. I don't want to say it wrong, but government is now force, and it's undeniable.
Government's right? Always been force. I mean, that's essentially the nature of government, but this is just a prime example of that. And so what I said initially when we read this story was, for anyone who tries to convince you that government does not equal force, I'd like to see them try and say that after reading this article.
You should keep in mind, though, that when Zuckerberg and the CEO of Yahoo are making these statements, like even saying what they've said so far, they're taking huge risks just in saying what they said, because they're acknowledging that they've received a communication from the security apparatus of the state at all. And the way these orders come down to you in business is that they order you to do things, and then they tell you, you may not tell anybody about this order at all. So that's why I can tell you, having been on the receiving end of one of these things myself, it is an absolutely terrifying thing because they're unrestricted. They say, you may not share this information with anybody. With anyone? Like, what about my brother, my mother, my wife, my coworkers, my attorney? I mean, anyone? But that's an unrestricted demand, the ultimate kind of totalitarian tactic. And the other thing that strikes you as incredible is that these orders could exist at all. You're like, well, wait a minute. I thought we had some kind of vague system of, you know, some remnants of a Bill of Rights, more or less.
Professor Tucker. Would you be so bold as to be more specific about that situation, or is it something that
can you share it with us? What happened?
Well, you know, here's the other thing. What's the statute of limitations? I mean, how long am I under this gag order? You know, sure. Until I die? I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I don't even know what to say about this nonsense. I'm just not for fear of me, but I don't know who else, you know, I'll get wrapped up into this if I explain too many details. Sure. But I'm just saying that I'm very sympathetic to these guys because, and I remember when all the Snowden revelations came out, you know, Google came out with its denials, and I was reading this stuff thinking, you know, I've been there, I've done that, I know what it's like. If Snowden's telling the truth, they are not legally permitted to do so. And also these guys, you know, they have a lot of responsibilities to stockholders, other employees, customers. It puts them in a terrible bind. There's no free society should be permitted to have these thugs on the loose like this. I mean, it's beyond belief. But you know, we don't, it's funny how few rights actually we have left. when you think about it. And I discover, you know, just in the course of my life, daily life, just how few rights. So, like, I discovered the day that that order came in, just, you know, how strange it was that I wasn't even, you know, I had my freedom of speech was completely taken away from me, you know. But just this last week, I was crossing over into the Canadian border. And I don't want to divert this conversation too much, but I'll just tell you very quickly. She didn't like my story about where I had been because it was a little too complicated. Too many airports, too many stops. So I went into a secondary screening, and they wanted to know who I was visiting in Canada. I told them, they said, well, you have the number. I said, well, you know, I'm not entirely sure. Let me just look it up. Okay, this is what an idiot does. Okay, let me look that up real quick. Look it up, unlock my phone, pull it up, show them the phone number. She says, well, let me look at that a little more carefully. And so I said, okay, like an idiot. I handed her my phone, right? She takes it and walks away into a back room, leaves me standing there, unguarded, you know, basically incarcerated, but unguarded, for 30 minutes, while I assume she mirrored my entire cell phone. Okay, so now suddenly every Facebook contact, every, you know, instant message I've ever sent, every email, my entire browsing history, how far I run in the mornings, you know, what I ate for dinner last night. I mean, you know, everything that's on my cell phone suddenly became the possession of the Canadian government, and that's my only point of relief here, so at least it's not the U.S. government. But how is this possible? You know, and then sure enough, about 2 days later, the New York Times, on the cover of the New York Times, it says, it turns out that border control is confiscating people's phones and laptops and mirroring them completely.
Yeah, you can never trust the great white menace of the North, okay?
Well, you know, but, and I'm not sure how I might have done it better. Like, what if I had let the battery run out completely, kept it in my sock, you know, buried it deep in my bags? I don't know. Would they have dug it out and still mirrored it? You know, I just don't know. But I feel like in retrospect, I shouldn't have made it so easy for them by unlocking my cell phone and handing it to a security agent at the border. I mean, how dumb was that, right? So you live and learn. But what, you know, where are our rights under these conditions? I mean, that so much for search and seizure, so much for anything. We live in a practical state of totalitarian. I mean, the state is a totalitarian enterprise at this point. One more question. I'm going to stop dominating the conversation. One more point I just wanted to make. I was just at a hotel in the Midwest, and I just happened to be there for a private meeting. Only six of us. We were planning a conference we're having this summer. But meeting at the same hotel were about 600 security professionals somehow linked with the U.S. Justice Department. They were meeting at this event, and so there's this gigantic, you know, convention of thugs. And it's very weird, actually, to see all these people in one place because they all have a kind of a similar way about them, I must say. But I was able to kind of walk through the halls where the convention was being held, listen to some of the talks, and see the kind of items that were being sold by the vendors, you know, like coffee mugs in the shape of guns with the word FBI on them. The most chilling shirt that was for sale by the vendors at this glorious, you know, meeting of fascist thugs was one that said, sometimes there's justice and sometimes there's just us. Because that was the shirt, a big selling shirt, you know. This is a convention of fascists, of essentially Nazis. These people just sit around reveling over their control of society. Here's the thing: law enforcement, at one point in all of our lives, at least in my lifetime, you could kind of see it as maybe part of the civilian order. From time to time, we believed that it was part of the civilian order, like an extension of us, maybe in some way, maybe possibly serving us. Maybe that was an illusion. But that illusion is completely gone now. Law enforcement is today waging a war on society. That's its ethos. That's its import. That's the way they understand themselves.
And I think Radley Balco has done extraordinary work in bringing that up and making a point. I mean, Radley Balco probably has single-handedly made us aware of that. The Huffington Post reporter who talks about, you know, police excesses and just wrote a new book about the warrior cop.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing thing. All weekend I enjoyed, not didn't enjoy it, but I would sort of, with two of these thugs would get to, or three or four of them would stand around in the lobby talking to each other. I would just kind of stand there nonchalantly listening to them, you know, and just the way they talk about killing, and I mean, they see the whole of society as this sort of seething mass of danger, you know, that they're out to just like basically crush. It's, we're going to kill you before you kill us. I mean, that seems to be the mentality. That was the ethos I picked up from this event, and it's absolutely chilling. I mean, the lines these days are being very starkly drawn.
So, I, you know, as I think about your story at the Canadian border, I wonder if we've created an idea for an enterprising person out there. You know, what if there is an app on your phone that gives a false profile upon scanning? What if there's a way to lock down your data and to give the false sense to the authorities that they've scanned your phone when they actually haven't?
Ryan, quick, copyright that.
That's a tool. That's an idea, guys.
Did any of you know that this was commonly going on?
Yeah.
I saw the story on the New York Times, and that really alerted me to the idea. There's also been, I think Snowden did a release, and I think The Guardian did a story where consulates were scanning laptops and cell phones globally. But as far as the Canadian border and whether they were gathering information, I think that was kind of new to the mainstream.
Here in Indiana, one of our Libertarian Party members, Evan McMahon, has single-handedly stopped in the last two General Assemblies a bill that would allow the use of phone downloaders, essentially. So if you're pulled over for a routine traffic stop and you're detained, not even if you're charged with anything, let alone convicted, if you're just stopped, then the police will confiscate your cell phone on a traffic stop and download all of the information in your phone. And Evan should be credited single-handedly for stopping this bill by going to the authors of the bill, going to key members of the legislature and saying, would you like this to happen to you? Do you want the police officers to have photos of your children and all of the personal contacts in your phone and making them aware of the just abuse of this?
Professor Tucker, I do have a question. We've talked about Bitcoin. We've talked about Facebook and LinkedIn. So these are ways that libertarians can trench around or trench under the communication and the market aspects of government. Now we've talked about justice a bit. What are your ideas around libertarians being able to trench under or around, I don't want to say circumvent for the NSA that's listening, but how do we bypass or do libertarian activities that get around the problem of justice in the country? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thing is never, if you can possibly avoid it, never be part of that system. And maybe that sounds obvious, but there's a lot of people who are really naive. They think that if they can, you know, somehow they'll be able to fight City Hall. You know, they'll go in, they'll fight a ticket, or they're not going to be bullied. They're going to go in and argue their own case. They're going to hire an excellent attorney. It could never work. I mean, the state always wins in the justice system. You want to avoid it as much as possible. I think that's a good principle. You have to be wise. You have to be smart. Sometimes that means paying fines when you don't want to, you know. But you never want to get embroiled in that system. I think Ed Snowden actually provides a good model in this respect, because he saw outrageous things going on at the NSA. Now, if he were a naive type, he would have just called, his senator.
Right. Okay.
And isn't that what they said? They said that we have these methods of recourse in place for whistleblowers. And why didn't he try and take one of those approaches?
He was smarter than that. He understood that what he was doing was, you know, that he would lose if he attempted that. So he decided to take a bold step, but he didn't trust the system to cooperate with him, you know.
He didn't hand over his unlocked cell phone?
Yeah, right.
See, we here on the We Are Libertarians radio network believe that Canada is one of the greatest dangers that the Western world faces. 98% of them live on the border, 98% live on the Canadian-American border, and that's for a reason.
So. Yeah, I wonder why. I think part of my own failing here is that sometimes I feel like I'll be able to charm the TSA, you know, or the people at the border or whatever. You know, a couple of drinks, you know, I'm getting off the plane. I'm like, hey, what's going on? It's great to see you. You know, and most of the time it goes well, you know. But I think in this case, I did a couple of things that just, you know, like I'm misstating my route. Okay, that was a big mistake. That was a big error. Like you just can't saunter up to the passport office and they say, where have you been? And you make a series of mistakes. Like, well, I flew into San Diego. Wait a minute. No, I think it was Los Angeles. Well, no, I drove to Los Angeles. I mean, you can't do that crap, right?
Right.
And I was doing this banter stuff. I had somebody tell me actually afterwards that we all need to kind of get practice at speaking as if we're in a deposition. I've never done that, but he explained it to me this way, that you never want to answer a question with an answer that calls forth new questions. So, somebody says, is the person you're going to see a Canadian citizen? You don't want to say, yes. Well, for how long? Well, 10 years. Well, where were they before? You know, because it just leads to more and more questions. Pretty soon they're digging down deeper and deeper. The best thing to say is, well, you know, I just really don't know. What do you mean you don't know? I just don't know.
Vague and evasive.
Right. But seemingly forthcoming, right? So non-hostile, but also no. You don't want to give an answer that's going to elicit yet another question. That's the way you have to be in a deposition. I thought that was very interesting advice. I mean, probably we all need to spend some time thinking about how, going through scenarios in our mind of how we're going to deal with the attempt to trap us. Which, let's face it, I mean, we're all like that close. I mean, we're all just one misstep away from incarceration these days. Not because we're libertarians, but just because we're human beings.
Well, and because we commit 3 felonies a day, right?
Yeah, that's right. The other thing is, you know, we all have things to hide. I mean, we're free and people. We have people with human rights. We do things on our own volition. Nobody's ever going to take that away from us. But as a consequence, there are things we do that we don't want the state to know about. That if the state did know about, we are very vulnerable to being captured, essentially. So, yeah, we probably all need to spend a little more time thinking about our very vulnerabilities and preparing for that. And I don't think the right way to deal with this is to become confrontational, because, as I say, you will definitely lose. So, yeah, how do you get around the justice system? How do you dig under it, go around it? The best thing you can do is be more clever than I've been in the past. You know, I'm going to be a little more clever in the future. Yeah.
Yep. As long as you didn't have any Geraldo Rivera selfies in your cell phone, I think you'll be okay.
Very good. Well, guys, as I mentioned before, this is what we call Jay Carney Says What. What we do is we put on our status hats for a little bit. We listen to a question, or we actually, I'll pose a question that Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, he was asked during a recent press conference. I'm going to give you 3 options, and what we're going to do is you're going to pick the option that you believe Jay Carney said during the press conference. Does that make sense? Question is, when you go back to the president's speech on Syria this week, it seems like he was saying we need action, but it's not going to be another Iraq. We're not going to put boots on the ground, but we don't pinprick. But we don't do pinpricks. It seems like a tough case to make, full of inherent contradictions. Would you comment on that, please? So that's the question posed to Jay Carney. Option 1, the president's comments stand on their own. Looking for contradictions in a situation like this does not help stop Assad from launching attacks against his own people, nor does it stop the needless deaths of innocent women and children. That's option 1. Option 2, I think your question makes it more complicated than it is. When it comes to the use of military force, this is a proposed limited military strike, limited in scope and duration. It would have a significant effect on Assad's capabilities, but it would not be an engagement that places American boots on the ground. That's option 2. Or option 3. There's a lot baked into that comment, including a loaded question. Clearly, this engagement is in stark contrast to Iraq. Those looking to draw comparisons between the two situations are performing a type of mental gymnastics to push their own agendas and ideas. Look, the president stated that under no circumstance will there be boots on the ground in Syria. Clearly, that's the difference here. The strikes are limited and focused on specific goals. Again, clearly different from Iraq. So option one, president's comments stand on their own, looking for contradictions is just a diversion from the mass genocide of Assad. Option two, the question was made more complicated than it really should be. Limited strike, limited scope, no boots. Option three, loaded question and clearly different than Iraq. Mr. Chris Spangle, which way are you going?
See, I liked the second one when you read it because it had just the right amount of condescension. And then you read number three, and it was condescending and hostile, so that's what I'm going with.
Chris Spangle is going number three. Professor Tucker, which one do you prefer, sir?
Well, I found the first one it's very compelling, and as I listened to the other two, I couldn't get it out of my head that the first one was the one that seemed most realistic. I think the second one's a little over the top in its rhetoric, and it's slightly unlikely.
So aren't you in for a treat?
All right, so Professor Tucker has taken number one. Joe Ruiz, which way are you going here?
I think that when I listened to the wording, I think number three had these kind of built-in pauses, and I could almost imagine Jay Carney saying those words with those built-in pauses. So I'm going to go with number three just because that's what the picture that I have painted in my head.
All right, so Professor Tucker is going with the contradictions are basically detracting from Assad's acts, and Chris and Joe are saying that they're going with the this is clearly different than Iraq answer, and this is why I love this game, guys. It's my favorite game because everyone is wrong.
Oh.
And I'm... Chris, you're still trailing Joe Ruiz here.
I'm like one.
I would have loved to have heard that. I didn't hear. I couldn't actually hear what you were playing. So it was number two. Number two. So the one with the over the top distracting from the Holocaust going on and blah blah blah.
Yes,
absolutely.
That's the thing about this game is it breaks it down and you really realize how ridiculous what he says is.
Yeah, so essentially when someone like me can come up with two other statements, either it says something about my status brain or it's just how shallow of comments Jay Carney makes. I'm not sure which. I hope it's the later. But
you know, I'm sure you've all seen this great movie, Wag the Dog. You know, war propaganda has never looked the same to me since I saw that movie.
It totally. This has that feel to it, doesn't it?
It really does. It's just hilarious. They've always got all these. And what always happens, too, is that people, you know, the public opinion polls are interesting because initially people are like, I don't want a freaking war with Syria, you know, or war with whomever. And then the rhetoric gets ever more ramped up and the war propaganda begins. And we begin to bet all this terrible suffering and then calling upon the U.S. as this great savior that's going to go in and fix up everything, never mind that every time we attempt something like this, we make everything worse and, you know, cause massive human suffering. And gradually the opinion polls begin to shift. But it seems like in this Syria case, isn't your impression that the warmongers are having a more difficult time than they might have expected?
It, you know, Dan Coats is our senator here in Indiana, and he made the comment that people are war-weary, but they're also war-wise now, and that they're wise to the war-making process. Now, that doesn't mean that he's a dove in the mold of a Rand Paul or, you know, Dennis Kucinich, but I think it's very, very true, and I think this is one of, if not the first war possibly stopped by social media. You know, the public opinion has just spread so quickly across the board, and people are seeing from their friends and family on Facebook why they disagree with this war. And in that initial phase in Iraq, there was, I don't know about this. But then all you got was the unfiltered message of the drumbeat of war. Now you don't have just that unfiltered message. You've got people, I'm sure you have probably 5,000 Facebook friends. I've got a lot of Facebook friends. Joe and Ryan have a lot of Facebook friends. And that blast out to their feed saying, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing this? What's the point? Why would we start arming Al-Qaeda on the anniversary of 9/11? Mm-hmm. And that spreads in public opinion is swayed to the negative side as opposed to the positive side. And study after study after study show that people will listen to their friends and family far more than they'll listen to the institutions that they no longer trust.
Chris, that is such an excellent analysis. Thank you for that. You know, I wonder how the history of the last 10 years would have been different if we'd had Twitter after 9/11. We didn't. Or if we had the ability to make, you know, movies of everything going on in our physical space with cell phones, which we didn't have back then. And I wonder if Twitter and Facebook and Google communities had been around in World War I, if we ever, maybe we never would have entered that war either. You know, certainly Pearl Harbor was, there are plenty of fishy things about that. It would have been Twittered out all over the place. I mean, it's a fascinating thing to imagine the communication. Just pure communication technology is going to give peace a greater chance than it's ever had. Amazing.
We always tell people to call their senators, call their congresspeople, and I'll call with something like Syria and have a five-minute conversation, and they're just like, yeah, okay, we'll let her know. And that's about the extent of it, and you don't really feel like my opinion is really going to be taken into consideration here. It's right. You don't get that overwhelming feeling. But when you get on Facebook and you see people changing their icons to this person opposes intervention in Syria. Right. And I mean, it's almost overwhelming. You're like, I am not alone in this. People, and even with Zuckerberg, you know, we posted an event that said Mark Zuckerberg take down Facebook for one day. And, you know, now he's responding because he must have at some point come across this idea that people are telling me to explain myself. So I think it amplifies our thoughts, and it amplifies our voice that we have all this technology out there.
Well, there's also, you remember what Aaron Schwartz was working on before he died, actually before he was harassed by the Justice Department. It was a kind of a new system for direct citizen to politician engagement, you know, creating sort of email swarms around these people. He imagined the possibility of a sort of direct democratic system would be brought about through technology. And he created an open source program for bringing this sort of thing about. And now those are being made alive. Many, many activist groups that allow you to go in to their websites and just send one email blast. You know, and that really does matter. I mean, these politicians aren't going to pay attention to one phone call, but they're going to get pretty alarmed if they've got, you know, 2 million communications pouring in to them every single second. I mean, even idiots began to take notice at that point.
Now, is it also fair to say that the libertarian movement within, especially the House of Representatives, has also largely prevented the strikes from occurring? I mean, if you look at, you know, specifically Congressman Justin Amash, you know, he goes into these intelligence briefings, he comes out and he tweets out and says, look, I just was in a classified intelligence briefing and the story is horrible, it's not convincing. You know, he's retweeting, you know, thousands of messages from veterans saying, please don't go to war. You know, he's being as transparent as he can without going to prison. You know, I know there's not a lot of these gentlemen in there in Congress, but it seems like there is this almost subversive libertarian strain that's going through that is really disrupting the power structures, even from within.
Yeah, and they need our support, really. I mean, people, when they take these kind of risks, I'm not much for political action, as you know, but every once in a while, when these people do really heroic things, they need our support and they need our encouragement. It's good.
While we have Jeffrey Tucker on, you made the comment one time about going on Google Plus and not wanting to go back there, and saying that if you're trying to sell anarchism as a model, then you might want to reflect a person that you'd want to enter in a voluntary relationship with. You know, there is sometimes there are just some of the comments that come back. You can't say anything about Justin Amash or any of the Pauls. You can't say this, you can't say that. And it just becomes sort of a burden putting things out there. Because
Chris, what do you mean that people like libertarians themselves attacking back and going, oh, that politician's not pure enough for me?
And it's not about a personal reaction. It's about putting on a good face, a good PR face for other people who are seeing these threads, other people who are engaging. When you're engaging back and forth, when libertarians are talking to each other, how are others seeing that? And I think a lot of times libertarians don't do a great job of presenting a good public relations face.
Well, that's exactly right. I think civility and intelligence should be really our watchwords in our movement. We need to be better at policing ourselves and always and always thinking about civil engagement and intelligent engagement, and not these kind of sort of rhetorical terror tactics that people are going. Here's the other thing. You know, if you spend more of your life attacking fellow libertarians than you do promoting liberty, I would say that there's a problem. You know, that's a problem. So, and yet there are many people in the world of liberty who do this. And I think it's just destructive and pointless. That's my own opinion about it. Internecine conflict and warfare and character assassination, that really should not be part of our rhetorical machinery. Hope and encouragement, drawing attention to the good, condemning real evil, that should be what we're about, creating internecine warfare.
I think that's a great message to wrap up on. Now, Professor Tucker, is there anything that you'd like to promote or events coming up that you could share with us?
Yeah, let me just tell you something. I can't believe that I mentioned this earlier, but I've got this really fun thing that I'm doing on October 5th in Atlanta. It's actually a cryptocurrency conference. We have an entire day-long conference to assess the role of Bitcoin in the overthrow of government paper money systems. I put the conference together because it didn't seem like anybody else was doing it. So I just jumped in, put my own money forward, and said, okay, here's the hotel, here's the cool speakers, let's just do this on spec. And next thing you know, I've got a lot of good organizations that are backing the thing now. Foundation for Economic Education is very pleased. The Bitcoin Foundation is involved. BitPay of Atlanta is holding a special reception. So now it's becoming this big deal. I mean, it's really been fun for me. So it's a day-long conference where I'm bringing together attorneys with monetary theorists, with code-slinging tech gurus and dorm room miners, bringing all these people together in one event, October 5th, in Atlanta. You can Google cryptocurrency conference and get all the information you want, but I'm really looking forward to that event.
Well, that's great. It sounds like it's just an amazing mesh of distinct individuals that should bring forth some interesting changes to the market.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this week, gentlemen. Excellent show. Thank you, Professor Tucker, for allowing us to dominate so much of your morning. We truly appreciate it.
It's really been fun. I've looked forward to this meeting now for several weeks. So thanks for making it fun for me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
What is your Twitter and what is the website that people ought to go to?
Well, I'm executive editor at Laissez Faire Books, so that's lfb.org. You can look me up on Twitter. I believe it's Jeffrey A. Tucker. And on Facebook, some guys established a kind of an official Jeffrey Tucker page, which is a little bit embarrassing for me, but I'm glad for you to go there and like it. And gosh, I'm all over the web. Anybody's free to write me at any time. Also, I said something at the beginning of this podcast about a little enterprise I'm developing. I think you will all be very pleased when you see what it is.
Excellent. We can't wait to hear about that. Hopefully you'll come back and tell us all about it.
Yeah, love to.
Excellent. So for those of you out there, if you'd like to leave a message for the We Are Libertarians group or the Shill Report cast, please go to the Facebook page. Find us on Twitter at We Are Libertarians and use the Shill Report hashtag to leave us a note. Find out what we left out of this episode on page 2 of the Shill Report, available at wearelibertarians.com. Listen in on iTunes or wall-radio.com to hear past episodes. And the Shill Report also plays on indianatalks.com. Be sure to visit lbf.org and check out the many wonderful books by Jeffrey Tucker and other libertarian authors. And remember, folks, when the media breaks the news, the Shill Report is here to fix it.
There's also, it seems to be a kind of a general fashion thing going on with bow ties these days.
Yeah.
Which I don't entirely understand. I've been wearing bow ties since I was about 17, maybe. Hmm. So 16, 17 years old. So I don't, I've never really paid attention to the whole fashion it amuses me, actually. I was just in the airport, and I always like to go by the Brooks Brothers or something when I'm in the airport and ask about the bow ties. And they said, we can't even keep them in stock. Everybody's buying this.
Yeah. I showed up at the Students for Liberty conference in Washington, D.C. this past February, March.
Yeah.
And I walk in and I see a one college student in a bow tie, a jacket, smoking a pipe, talking to a kid with a giant mohawk. It's like, well, I have arrived.
Welcome to the Liberty Movement.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah. That's really great. That event, Chris, was an amazing event, don't you think?
It is. It really is. I mean, it gives you so much insight into the next generation of libertarians. You know, first of all, the whole myth of libertarians are just, you know, your average white male, you know, INTJ. You know, there is a broad spectrum of new libertarians. And the other thing is, they don't care about party. They only care about the person that they're supporting. So Republicans, libertarians, even Democrats, they just don't care about the political party. And I thought that was really, really kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's another feature too that I've detected too, is that people are starting to realize that the progress towards human liberty is going to involve more than political activity. You know?
Yeah.
That it's going to involve enterprise, entrepreneurship, serious work to rebuild our sort of cultural, social foundations, putting networks of friendships together. This kind of building stage is just as important, if not more so, than any kind of political activity, because it's very likely that the change will not come from the center. It'll come from underneath, from organically, from within society, through innovation and cleverness. We're going to outsmart the state. We'll probably never dismantle it.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ryan's going to fill you in on the details here while I hit start, and because that sort of ties into one of my questions for you. So, Ryan, give me about 5 seconds, and then...
Sure.
So, do you have any questions
for us?
We're
just going to intro the show, get everything set up and going, then we'll jump right into the interview. We've got... I think Joe sent the show notes, correct? So you know the two stories that we're going to also dig into?
Yep.
And then we play a game at the end. It's called Jay Carney Says What? So I'm sure you're familiar with White House Press Secretary Jay Carney.
Mm-hmm.
We take a question from the press pool, we pose it to you guys, and you guys have to guess one of three answers which one's correct. So you have to put on your status brain for a few minutes and see if you can figure out what this, what he said. So, kind of amusing, but that's pretty much it. So we're going to do an intro, we're going to do a quick open the show, then we're going to jump right into the interview. Sound good?
Good.
All righty, Chris, are you ready?
Ready.
Okay, and that this is something that you're an aficionado of now. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was surprised to see.
I have a second life.
I am familiar. I'm Methodist, so I'm familiar with sacred music, and I had no the Sacred Music Journal. I had no idea that you were the editor of that, let alone a part of it. So that was really interesting to find when I was looking through the show prep.
Yeah, it's a little bit weird. I mean, it's not so weird to me because, you know, I get so intrigued about the fact that Gregorian chant is so old. You know, it dates probably back to the apostolic age, but certainly it came into its own in the 6th, 7th, 8th centuries. And just as melodies, they're so beautiful, but what's most impressive to me from a political point of view is that these melodies have persisted beyond any existing nation state in the world. So the melodies themselves are more robust than any state. Just one line of music, you know, somehow last longer than any of the existing nation state on the planet. That gives a clue as to the vibrancy of the human spirit in the face of power and the attempt to manage it. Nobody can manage this world.
Yeah, to think
that
you're singing the same piece of music that Martin Luther wrote or Saint Francis wrote, it really blows your mind.
Or anonymous people, or anonymous poor monks and you know, illiterate culture in the 6th, 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, you know, it comes down to us peer to peer, one node after another, a big open source distributed network. And 1,500 years later, we're still singing this stuff.
So right? in our digital world, we have access to just vast amounts of chant. So for someone like me who wants to get back into it, what should I go out to iTunes and download? What's the one that you think's the great reintroduction to this beautiful music?
There's a monastery in Vienna that specializes in Cistercian chant called the Stift Heiligenkreuz. And I think it's called something like The Beauty of Chant. You can look it up, Stift. It means like the Holy Heiligenkreuz, Stift Heiligenkreuz. So what is that? The Holy Cross, something like that. Holy Cross Monastery in Vienna. And their chant is like so perfect. I just can't believe how perfect this chant is. So, I mean, I'm obsessed with this topic. I conduct a chant choir myself, and I'm intrigued by it. I like the way chants tell stories, too. The way they are able to evoke the parables of the Bible and all the passages, you know, the words of Christ, and in a pre-literate world, and you know, I can't let go of it. I'm intrigued by it. To me, it represents the ultimate triumph of the human spirit, especially one inspired with a faith-based mission to overcome every obstacle, to transmit over time and space, truth and beauty. You know, that's just really exciting to me. So that's why I've done so much work on the subject and why I can't seem to let go of it. And people wonder, like, what the hell this is all about, you know, but there you go.
No, it's absolutely, it's beautiful. It's inspirational. I find it meditative. It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you
there
for...
There was something else I wanted to mention. You're in Indiana, Chris?
Yeah, all three of us are in Indiana. I'm in Indianapolis, Joe's in South Bend, and Ryan is in Fort Wayne.
Okay, so Chris, did you know that I was just in Indianapolis?
I did not, no. Were you here? The name I was trying to think of earlier was the Liberty Fund is located
no,
here.
No, I was there for an organizing meeting for the Sacred Music Colloquium this summer, but we stayed in the Sheraton downtown
okay.
in Indianapolis. And that's where that Justice Department meeting was taking place.
Really? Yeah, that's blocks from my office. I work just right downtown. So anytime you're coming to Indianapolis, send me a message and let's get together.
Yeah, we should have gotten together. It was a pretty town, a lovely place. I really enjoyed being there, but I tell you what, that convention was pretty creepy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who's the guy? Do you all watch Breaking Bad? Who's the,
yes.
the DEA agent?
Hank.
Yeah.
Hank. Yeah, it's like a whole convention of Hanks. Yeah.
So,
wow.
Oh, well, yeah, that it would be great to have, you know, we have a lot of conventions here in Indianapolis. That's one of the things that they've tried to reinvigorate Naptown or Indianoplace with is the conventions and bringing in income. So I'd love to get together if you're ever in town.
Thank you. Well, actually... I will be in town there next June for a full week. So for, in fact, this event that we are planning. So let's get together if you're available.
That'd be great.
I'll let you know. Thanks again, guys. It was fun being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right.